Increasing public confidence in medicine, which would lead to the possibility of a much more paternalistic kind of medical ethical milieu, that is to say, a milieu in which physicians would expect compliance and even obedience from patients, this would not have been possible in the 19th century without the concomitant rise in esteem for the profession of nursing. The profession of nursing, and indeed the whole practice of healthcare, went into what I've termed eclipse, particularly at the beginning of the 19th century, and also this had begun some time before, for a whole variety of reasons, and I've listed some of these in number 3.1. Formerly, there had been religious communities particularly devoted to the care of the sick, and even the foundation of communities, particularly communities of women, that were devoted to the practice of nursing. However, as we will recall, significant parts of Europe had gone over to the Reformation in the 16th century, and the religious orders had been disbanded. This had the effect, and this was especially true in the English-speaking world, of leaving a tremendous gap in terms of care for the poor, both in terms of nutrition and also in terms of what medical care was available. The monasteries and communities of England prior to the Reformation had provided what we would today call public service. When the monasteries were dispersed, the monks were dispersed, and the monasteries were claimed by the crown, and the properties then awarded to those nobles who had been loyal to the crown, this had the effect of removing effective social care agencies without anything in their place. The nobles who took over these institutions were often not very interested in or capable of providing the kind of care, or at least the kind of charity that had formerly been provided by the religious institutions, and the notion and the practice of such care went into a significant period of decline. Something similar happened even within Catholic Europe, particularly during the period of the Enlightenment, when there was a tendency to dismiss religious life, monasticism, as a dangerous and parasitic phenomenon left over from the past that needed to be transcended. There was strong encouragement to Catholic rulers to, as I've put in the text, emulate their Protestant brothers and sisters and secularize the institutions, which would have the effect of making their lands available to the state. And this did happen in such Catholic countries as France and Bavaria and Austria, and the religious communities came under increasing government control, and many of them were simply disbanded. The French Revolution was even more destructive. Religious communities were made practically illegal, and were in fact made illegal. Monasteries and members of religious communities were offered the opportunity, or they offered the option of either complying with the state's regulations to go along with the state's new laws, which included denying that Rome had any right to affect the church in France, as well as requiring that the members of religious communities leave their communities and either engage in public service in towns or simply take a pension. They were offered the option of doing this or of being guillotined. So religious life in the portions of the Empire of Napoleon that came under the sway of the French Revolution were significantly depopulated in terms of the institutions that had formerly cared for the sick. And as the text has pointed out, this could not have happened at a worse time because this was also a period of increasing industrialization. We've mentioned the significant injuries that were beginning to occur as a result of large machinery and factories, urbanization, people moving into towns and overcrowding without adequate sanitary facilities, and if you add this into the mix of diminished institutions caring for the sick, you have a real tragedy. And as I've pointed out, perhaps rather romantically, into this desperate situation, the situation of malaise, there came a truly remarkable and heroic woman named Florence Nightingale, section number section 3.2, who really single-handedly renewed and revived healthcare and indeed more or less created the profession of nursing, at least in the English-speaking world. Of course, there had still existed nursing orders on the continent, and Florence Nightingale herself visited some of these as a young woman and then went for training to a Lutheran deaconess institute. I should mention that Lutheran deaconesses in the 19th century were an attempt on the part of the Lutheran churches in Germany to revive something of a monastic tradition for women. These were celibate religious communities for women which were dedicated to public service, and in this case, in the setting of a Kaiserwerth, to healthcare. First, a little bit about Florence Nightingale herself. Her family was moderately well-to-do. That is, she could be provided with enough of an income by her parents, by her father, that she would not actually have to work for a living. But she experienced what she called a religious conversion, a call from God, in 1837 at the age of 16. And she believed that she was being invited by the Lord to embrace care for the poor, and in particular, care for the sick. Now, if you read the novels of Charles Dickens, you will realize that the nursing profession in England was not held in high regard. Often, people who were available to care for the sick were not of the highest moral character. Many of them were addicted to alcohol or to laudanum, to various opium compounds, and were not very trustworthy. Florence Nightingale almost single-handedly created a noble and highly esteemed profession of nursing for women, somewhat against the wishes of her family and of her parents. She had experienced this sense of a call from God, and she finally was allowed by her parents at the age of 31 to go for 3 months to the Lutheran Deaconess Institute at Kaiserwerth, and then after her training to initially superintend an institution for ill governesses, for ill women who were effectively in what we would today call an extended care facility, a nursing home in London. And then she discovered what was going on in the Crimea during the Crimean War, England's involvement in the war that involved Russia. She read of the appalling condition of the soldiers and organized a band of women consisting of individuals trained like herself and members of, from the continent, members of religious orders who had been trained in nursing. And she led a team which was authorized by the British Army that went to Scutari in the Crimea and discovered how really horrible the healthcare conditions were. The physicians who were involved in caring for the wounded soldiers deeply resented Florence Nightingale's presence, but were more or less forced to accept her presence there. She instituted changes which primarily consisted in improving hygiene. She would make sure that the soldiers had clean linen. She basically had the women organized both as healthcare workers who would clean wounds, but also would simply provide work as laundresses to make sure that there were clean bandages, and that the horrible conditions of unsanitary conditions of raw sewage that were present in the caverns and basements where the soldiers were being housed were cleaned, were flushed out. And effectively, her contribution and the lives that were saved were primarily through instituting such things as fresh air, fresh water, and making sure that patients were not being contaminated with human waste. And this was particularly important with cholera, which became rampant. Cholera is a disease which will break out whenever human waste products contaminate human water supplies, because certain human beings harbor the bacterium, the Vibrio cholerae, in their digestive tracts that will cause cholera, a very, very severe illnesses. Those carrier individuals are not necessarily afflicted, but if waste contaminates water supplies, cholera will appear, whether it's the case of Hurricane Katrina in our own century or any other situation. The primary thing one has to do is to separate the drinking water from the sewage. It sounds basic and simple, but it wasn't simple in the 19th century. And implementing that very basic principle saved tremendous numbers of lives, both in the Crimea where Florence Nightingale worked, and then, as we'll see later, in the application of public health and hygiene regulations in large cities. Just to go on, after her work in the Crimea, she was kind of pushed out by the medical establishment, which still deeply resented her, and then back in England, she was able to have a tremendous influence as a political reformer. She was celebrated as a heroine. The picture that I've given, the lady with the lamp, was reproduced thousands of times. Soldiers who would return would describe how despairing and hopeless they were, and yet there was this woman who would appear at night holding a lamp, doing rounds in the late hours of the evenings, checking on them, making sure that they were okay, seeing that they weren't sitting in their own waste products, cleaning them up and organizing her nurses, and they knew that she had saved their lives. Their stories went back to England, and she was celebrated as a national heroine. So she was capable of influencing political policy, which she did. She implemented and encouraged the development of institutions that would train professional nurses, and through her influence and through the almost mythic quality of the stories about her that then began to circulate in Victorian England, she was a powerful influence for the elevation of the status of nursing to a recognized and honorable profession, which it really had not been during her childhood. So it really is the story of a woman who was able to single-handedly influence tremendous changes in that profession. Now, that was not only true in England. Her work was spread to the United States, and after the Civil War, her methods were implemented in the United States as well, and in other countries as a result of the popularity which her methods acquired. Moving down now to Section 4, Public Health and Hygiene. This is vitally important for us because what we will find beginning in the 19th century and then extending into the 20th century up to the time of World War II is a progressive popular sense that the medical establishment may be relied upon. That, as we'll see, you can always trust your physician. And in many cases, this public perception was not primarily based on what medical science was actually providing, but on the broader questions of public health and hygiene, rather like the very simple and straightforward methods of hygiene that Florence Nightingale had brought to the soldiers in the Crimea. A very good example of the developing science of epidemiology, that is, studying the outbreak of epidemics and trying to determine how to stem them, is the work of Dr. John Snow, who in the early part of the 1800s of the 19th century played a vital role in stemming and stopping an outbreak of cholera, which we've already mentioned will occur whenever human waste products contaminate the water supply, and that's exactly what happened in London. The River Thames was used not only as a source of drinking water, but also as a sewer. And so it's not surprising that if the outflow is just upstream of the intake, you will have contaminated water. And so in 1854, there was a horrific outbreak of cholera. Snow was a scientifically oriented physician, and he analyzed the cases by simply plotting them on a map. Where are these cases occurring? And the outbreak was really frightening to people. Overnight, as I've mentioned in the text, within a radius of a few blocks, there were 56 new cases. But one day later, there were 153, and 70 people had died. So Snow simply looked at the, if you will, demographics, you know, dotting where the outbreaks had occurred. He noticed that they were clustering around a particular place, and he determined that the cluster was focused on people who drew their water from what was called the Broad Street Pump, a particular pump that pumped up water from the Thames River. And rather than going through all the technical procedures of having the area condemned, he simply got permission to remove the handle of the pump. And as soon as that was done, the outbreak ceased. So he demonstrated that it was, in fact, contaminated water that had caused this outbreak. Now, it wasn't until later that it was realized that this was caused by a bacterium that was causing cholera. And the disease of cholera, which again is something that Florence Nightingale had to deal with, can be treated by simply replacing the fluids that the person loses. But the individual afflicted by cholera acquires a horrific and constant form of diarrhea that makes replacement fluid therapy extremely difficult, especially prior to the advent of intravenous therapy, which really wasn't very widespread until the first quarter of the 20th century. But nonetheless, the treatment of this disease simply consisted primarily of replacing fluids. If we drop down then to number 4.2, this is a very important point. Popular appreciation of the medical profession is now on the rise. People are no longer deriding their physicians. They are looking to them with hope. They are believing that medicine will provide them with cures. Medicine will be able to be a new source of new and longer life. And indeed, the death rate was dropping. Now, the interesting thing, and that's the reason for this section, is that the reason for the decrease in the death rate, the decrease in the mortality rate throughout the 18th, 19th, and early 20th centuries has been plotted and has been very carefully studied. And although popular, if you will, mindsets and even kinds of wishful thinking wanted to believe that it was because medicine was becoming much more advanced and more medical therapies were available, that isn't what was actually saving lives. I've listed several of the most important factors from the epidemiological work, that is the study of disease and their spread by the McKinleys and McCohen. And they've noted that the most important factors were, number one, improvement in nutritional status. Give people food and they don't die as quickly. Number two, improvements in their living environment, coupled with number three, C, impact of hygiene and public health measures. Separate the water supply from the toilets. Don't allow the water supply to be contaminated, and suddenly you have this tremendous drop-off in the death rate. Don't allow people to be overcrowded. Don't force people to live together so closely that they very quickly spread disease to one another. And another factor, which was only analyzable much later in the 20th century, were actual genetic changes in the biological organism that causes the disease. This is a fascinating factor in the study of the history of disease. Sometimes it's extremely difficult to know which disease was present at any given period, because sometimes diseases in antiquity had very different, not so much presentations as virulence, that is to say, their capability of being very serious than they are today. For example, anthrax, a disease which primarily afflicts cattle and other animals but can infect human beings, was very, very dangerous and virulent in the Middle Ages and may even have been responsible for outbreaks of what was thought to be the bubonic plague or Black Death during the Middle Ages. The disease of syphilis, for example, was extremely lethal in the early years of the 16th century. It was a very dangerous and rapidly deadly illness. So changes in the way that organism infects human beings mean that diseases are sometimes difficult to track and, in fact, may result in a decreased death rate that has nothing to do, strictly speaking, with the treatment of the illness. All of this is summarized in this chart, which I'm sorry is a little fuzzy, called crude death rate per 1,000, and it starts from before the year 1750 and carries on through to the beginning of the 21st century. And the point of it is that there is a first period that involves a substantial drop in mortality, very great improvement in the length of time people live. This is caused from before 1750 until about 1838 simply by improved nutrition. Give people more food and they don't die as quickly. So that's what you have the greatest drop from during that period. The next greatest drop from roughly 1838 until the period of the 1940s, until the introduction of effective antimicrobial drugs, drugs that actually that actually fight against particular organisms, sulfa drugs, and then the introduction of antibiotics. The next period, the real drop takes place because of simply improved sanitation. Again, separating the clean water supply from the sewage. So you have the overwhelming majority of improvement in the mortality rate during this period has nothing to do with better medical treatment of specific diseases. It consists of giving people adequate food and giving them clean water and not contaminating the water. If you do that, there is a substantial improvement in the mortality rate. Then there is a much smaller but significant improvement based on the introduction of very specific scientific discoveries, particularly antimicrobials and antibiotics. So all of this is by way of saying that the popular perception at the beginning of the 20th century that medicine was now so far advancing that it was actually improving the human lifestyle and was actually resulting in a substantial drop in the death rate was somewhat deceptive. It wasn't anesthesia, it wasn't antisepsis, it wasn't the few drugs that had been added, the effective drugs that had been added to the physician's armamentarium. It was simply hygiene and public health, making sure people had calories, adequate food, and that people had clean water. However, as we'll see, nevertheless, this contributed to an atmosphere in which medicine could be regarded as trustworthy and even, in a certain sense, divinized, regarded as a discipline that would so substantially change and improve the nature of humankind that whatever physicians said could indeed be trusted.